I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the first half of an interview with Gary Greenberg about his book, The Manufacturing of Depression. For the second half of the interview, go to IEET.org. I'm speaking today with Gary Greenberg. Gary is an author of several books, most recently the one we're going to talk about today, Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. But he has written a lot of really wonderful articles for magazines that include Harper's, New Yorker, Wired, Discover, Rolling Stone, and Mother Jones. And he happens to live right here in Connecticut and recently had a book launch right in our neck of the woods in Willimantic, which was a lovely event. Thanks for coming in today, Gary.
It was my pleasure.
I don't get a chance to interview people in the studio very often. So.
And I don't get a chance to get an interview that's so close by very often.
There have always been books about depression and about mental health, but it seems like in recent years there's a lot of pushback against the concept of depression, and your book is going to be one of the books that is central to that. But I want to mention two other recent books. Barbara Ehrenreich recently wrote a book about American optimism. I'm spacing on the name of it now. But
The Bright-Sided.
The Bright-Sided, that's right. And argued that we had an ideology of positivism in the United States that had contributed both to selling self-loathing to the working class and irrational exuberance to the investing class. And Ethan Waters has come out with a book called Crazy Like Us, about the exporting of American mental health categories. And so the first question I want to ask you is, in this book, Manufacturing Depression, you tell the historical story, which is also an international story, about the invention of the diagnosis and the expansion of the diagnosis of depression. But do you think that this is also a characteristically American obsession that we have, you know, that we have the right to happiness, as the Declaration says?
Yeah, I think probably every civilized people have worried over the question of, you know, what makes you happy and how to get there. I mean, if you read the ancient Greeks, they were obviously very interested in this question. So it's not like we made up the question. But the idea of dedicating a society to the pursuit of happiness is something that is, I think, more or less unique to American culture. And so I think that gives a certain shape to the questions about happiness. And when it comes to pathology, the pathology of not being happy, it gives a particular shape to that as well, and a kind of urgency to take care of the problem.
Mm-hmm. When I have, I've taught two classes now on the sociology and public policy of happiness, and international happiness studies have for 40 years been asking people how happy they are in different societies. And you find that, for instance, Nigerians are very happy and Eastern Europeans are very unhappy. But it always seems like that there's a fundamental flaw that certain societies don't feel like happiness is obligatory for, you know, the good life, like, you know, that your average Ukrainian doesn't go around thinking about happiness in the same way that the average American does. So that when you ask them, are they happy, their first response is going to be, well, of course I'm happy because I'm a normal person.
Right.
Yeah.
And in fact, the whole question, are you happy, seems like to me when people start asking me, I have no idea where do you begin answering the question. It doesn't really compute with me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, it may just be a trivial question. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but it may be, if that question is about what is the good life and have you or are you achieving it, then it makes a little more sense. But to ask it that way turns it from a psychological question into a sort of a spiritual or sociological question, maybe, in which what you're really wondering is what makes life worth living and have I made myself a life worth living? And I think that's probably a more robust question, mm-hmm, than the question of whether or not we're happy. And so when you see these books, because I've recently been looking at this politics of happiness thing too, this new Derek Bach book,
right,
for instance.
Right.
And when you see these books of people making policies about achieving happiness, or a country like Bhutan, which has its gross national happiness index, you just wonder, well, exactly what are you up to?
Right.
And does it have anything to do with really important questions, like what is the good life and how do we know it's the good life and how do we get there?
Right. Bhutan is having a recent spike in suicide rates. It doesn't seem to be doing much successfully around that question, by the way. I definitely agree. I mean, Derek Bach, the conclusion from teaching this course twice was that basically you can take the facts, the voluminous facts about happiness, and spin them any way you like. You can argue for radically conservative policies. You can argue for gay marriage. You can argue against gay marriage. You can argue for anything you want, because everything points in different directions. Well, your book is partly a critique of medicalization, empirical reductionism around depression, a critique of the biologization of depression. And you are a practicing psychotherapist.
That's right.
And you don't practice cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the new hot thing in therapeutic approaches to depression. You practice a more introspective version of psychotherapy. So is this book special pleading for introspective psychotherapeutic approaches?
No. I don't think so. I mean, of course, it's part of the background of prejudices that I carried into the book, but I don't have any huge ambitions, either personally as a therapist or for the profession. I think it's a profession that is interesting and it works for certain people, but the idea that somehow I'm writing a book against biological psychiatry in order to promote psychotherapy, I'm not. I think that the book is pretty skeptical of most approaches, because I am skeptical of practices that attempt to guide people's lives. I think have to be really careful. I think we're way too glib, whether it's about medicine or therapy or anything else that we do to help people achieve the good life. I think we leave way too many questions unasked when we do that, and so you have the grounds for huge misunderstanding and huge trouble. Mm-hmm. So I try actually not to advocate anything in this book, which drives many readers absolutely nuts.
Well, that's what I found, was that I kept looking for the place where you're going to say there is no such thing as depression, there is no such thing as a chemotherapeutic approach that works, and you never really say that. You say it's been oversold, evidence has been ignored, but you acknowledge that there's a biology, that the brain is biological, consciousness is biological.
Yes, I say every morning I wake up and say, thank God for my brain chemicals, right? Because where would I be without them? I wouldn't have had those dreams. I won't have whatever experiences I have today. I mean, it just seems to me like a no-brainer, so to speak.
Right.
That brain chemicals are there, and they're capable of giving us whatever experience we have. They're a necessary condition for whatever experience we have. But I'm not sure that they're a sufficient condition. Mm-hmm. For our experience, and it's in that little gap between the necessary and the sufficient that I try to insert my book, because there, without saying, no, there's no such thing as brain chemistry or it's trivial, I'm saying, well, it's probably important, but how important is it? And more to the point, how can we be certain? We can't really know how the mind is related to the brain. There are people who say we know. But we don't know. And psychiatry implicitly says that it knows. And that drives me wild. That makes me nuts, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That psychiatrists, and particularly neuroscientists, say, to the extent that they do say this, that they know how the mind is related to the brain. They don't.
One of the questions around diagnosis is always, if you're looking at something, is it something where you either have it or you don't? Or is it something where it's a sliding scale of the bell curve of humanity, and you may still have to make a decision? Well, when you get to the third standard deviation, we're going to call that sick. But I think the critics of the expansion of the diagnosis of depression tend to see mental states or moods as the bell curve. And the biological psychiatrists tend to see it as like cancer. You either got it or you don't. Which may not even make sense, since we know that we have a little bit of cancer all the time anyway. But anyway, So you, I think, are more of a Belkervian on this.
I would say that what's happened is that the way this is talked about in the industry is dimensional diagnosis versus categorical diagnosis, where categorical is binary and dimensional is on a spectrum. And I would say that no reasonable diagnostic scheme can be categorical. Now, right now, the psychiatry is saddled with a categorical scheme, and they know it. They know it's a problem, and they're trying their best to fix it. Unfortunately, if they go back to a dimensional scheme, then they essentially undo the last 30 years of diagnostic, what looks to them like diagnostic progress, because they have expended great energy on trying to locate psychiatric diseases in nature. And even though you and I and almost anybody else knows that, as you said earlier, you know, you can have a little bit of cancer, that almost every disease is along a spectrum. Psychiatry, more than most other medical disciplines, needs to have things black and white because it's in so much danger mm-hmm. of seeming like a socially or culturally relative practice that it has to make an even stronger case for itself. And so to give up the categorical diagnoses is then to open up a whole host of questions that they thought they had shut the door on 35 years ago. So stay tuned. You know, we'll see what happens when the new DSM comes out in 2013, whether they succeed in going to a spectrum model. The alternative is to tie all psychiatric diagnosis to biological data, mm-hmm. which they're not about ready to do, but this is what they would like to do, in which case you won't have to worry about the dimensions. Mm-hmm. You'll just decide that a certain pattern, a certain brain pattern, whatever, a certain blood level of cortisol corresponds to depression, and then anything else before that that doesn't meet that, doesn't reach that threshold isn't depression.
Which people are trying to do, but there's no one-to-one correspondence between mental states and these these models.
And why would we expect there to be? I mean, right. There's 100 billion neurons in the brain, maybe. Maybe there's more. And they still haven't stopped discovering neurotransmitters. And each of those 100 billion neurons is multiply connected to each of the others. So how many trillion connections are there? I mean, there's more connections than there are dollars in the national deficit, which is a huge number. Mm-hmm. So this means to me that first of all, any explanation that really exhausts the entire that tells you what the entire brain chemistry of any given experience is going to be immensely complex, probably too complex to use. And it also tells you that it's possible, most likely, that every experience is could be heterogeneous, that it could be achieved in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think that that's going to pan out anytime soon.
Now, you personally have suffered from depression, and a lot of the book is an interweaving of this fascinating historical story of depression and its economic and political consequences with your own personal narrative about your experience. And part of your experience was that you had a catalytic lifting of your depression from taking the drug MDMA. And you have done a lot of research on MDMA in terms of serotonin and its effects. People are doing research, and you've been following it. Reflect on that for a second. I mean, it seems like ketamine, MDMA, even though the SSRIs have been shown to have been oversold because of the suppression of clinical evidence, it seems like there is a story around serotonin and potential things that have impacted serotonin in the brain and our ability to change our mood.
Well, in fact, the entire antidepressant era owes its existence to LSD, mm-hmm. Which is an interesting story that psychiatrists should be glad to tell, but they aren't if they know it. And because what happened was that in the late 1940s, LSD was discovered, and it was out there, and it was being used for many different purposes, including intrapsychic exploration. And at the same time, serotonin had been isolated in the brain, of the mammalian brain. And at that time, there was no confidence in the idea that the brain operated by chemical neurotransmission. And when serotonin was discovered in the brain, some psychiatrists, neuroscientists, started to put two and two together. They said, okay, we have serotonin in the brain, LSD and serotonin chemically are related. LSD actually contains within it the serotonin molecule. And when you take LSD, you have these profound changes in consciousness. So maybe what's going on is the serotonin is somehow implicated in our ability to be normal. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the thought was, well, maybe a lack of serotonin would cause mental illness of all kinds. So just for start from the beginning, serotonin has been deeply implicated in our understanding of drugs and our understanding of mental illness, and has held out this huge promise to neuroscientists of both understanding these things and also curing our problems. Mm-hmm. Now, when MDMA is a drug that, unlike LSD, which sort of mimics serotonin, which fools the brain, MDMA simply potentiates a huge release of serotonin into the brain, a flood of it. And it also happens to potentiate an experience pretty universally, that of being without fear and of being
loving,
open to the world, really open to the world. And so when I took that drug after a couple of years of being depressed, and in a moment, as I describe in the book, sort of a nanosecond, to have 2 years of depression just disappear was an immensely powerful, life-changing experience. Now, what do you walk away from that with? Well, I walk away from that with two things. One of them is, once again, thank God for my brain chemicals and also for the drugs that will enhance them. And secondly, I walk away from that thinking, well, look at this other possible way of being in the world. Regardless of if it was inspired by a drug or not, this is something to aspire to. Mm-hmm. So even if what's happening is that the drug is creating, even give it the drug that much, is creating the experience, the purpose of that is still to aspire toward it and to approach that without drugs, if you can.
Yeah, we've talked to a lot of Buddhists. We're very interested in this show, in the relationship between Buddhism and neurochemistry. So we talked to a lot of Buddhists about the history of at least Western Buddhism with psychedelics and now with Ritalin and potential cognitive enhancement drugs. And I think, you know, one of the perspectives that of course, I'm sympathetic with is that drugs can open your mind to the possibility of a different way of looking at things. It's very difficult to sustain, at least with the drugs we have now, to sustain, you know, any kind of insight or clarity or anything like that. But as you describe it, and I think the story that you tell around the recent ketamine research is the same, that ketamine is something that opens people's minds to the possibility of seeing the world without depression and allows them that opportunity, but it doesn't necessarily fix the brain.
Right, and in the book, when I write about the ketamine research, I mean it's absurd the way that research is presented, as if these people's actual experience of the drug doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. There's no mention, entire article about this, there's no mention of what the people actually thought mm-hmm. or felt right. while they were doing
the
drug.
It's the magic bullet approach to disease, yeah. Now, you mentioned the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and the huge fight that's been going on around every revision of the DSM. What do you see coming down the pike in terms of psychiatry's approach to depression, how it's changing? You talk at the end of your book about the possibility of a diagnosis of melancholia, rehabilitating melancholia as a diagnosis. I mean, what is happening with that?
Well, the problem that they have, I don't really know what they're going to do, but the problem that they have is pretty clear. The diagnosis, intentionally or not, and I don't see any big conspiracies here. It's just people doing what they do. The diagnosis was created in a way that makes for the maximum number of people to come under it. Because, first of all, it's not tied to anything outside of the symptoms. And secondly, the symptoms are what we know to be the sort of classic experience of mourning. And there are many things to mourn in our lives, not just when somebody dies, but you lose a job, your spouse, you get divorced, things change. And so mourning is a constant feature of our lives, and yet it's also this experience that's called depression. Mm-hmm. So it creates a market. Now, that also creates a lack of credibility. Nobody who thinks about this for more than about 10 seconds can fail to see this problem. And in fact, it's come to a head because in a book a couple of years ago, Jerry Wakefield and Alan Horowitz, they did the research and they showed that there was no reason to think that, well, I should back up and say, there's an exception in the DSM for depression. If you have all the symptoms of depression and you've recently been bereaved, you're not depressed. Mm-hmm. Well, Horowitz and Wakefield did some research that showed that there's no real difference between mourning the loss of a loved one and one of these other traumas. So why is there only an exception for grieving? Well, the answer is because it was marketing, mm-hmm. because it would look stupid not right. to have that exception. Well, the psychiatrists have seemed to be deciding that the solution to this problem, rather than to expand the analysis of what's actually causing people's depression, they've decided to eliminate the bereavement exception. So that points in the direction that we're going here. We're not going to go to in a direction that's going to make the market smaller. Mm-hmm. If they have to choose reducing the market or increasing the validity of the diagnosis, they're going to choose keeping the market.
Well, part of the happiness research has been this notion of a happiness set point and a certain amount of resilience. And so, you know, that pushes against this notion that we should be expanding the diagnosis. It should say that anybody left, you know, anybody responding to normal circumstances like bereavement or unemployment will eventually bounce back to whatever their happiness set point is. And we should only be treating people who are chronically and persistently hyperthymic or depressed. But you're saying that it's going the other direction.
It would appear to. Because to turn it around and to talk about it in terms of a resilience spectrum or something like that is so foreign to the approach we have to medicine. And remember, what's behind all of this, I believe, is psychiatry's need to stay in the mainstream of medicine. So it's unlikely that they're going to let go of their hold on pathology and risk being sort of laughed out of the medical kingdom. On the other hand, if that were to happen, then what you'd be doing is you would have to clarify your philosophy of what resilience consists of, how you distinguish between resilience and complacency. So, for instance, right now, Martin Seligman is training the Army to be more resilient to trauma.
Right.
Well, it is fair to ask, is that really a good idea?
Right.
Is it really a good idea to take the horror out of horror? Because if it isn't a good idea, we should know that before we start. Because his notion is not only do you make them more resilient, you actually move the distribution so that they become more like the people who grow from trauma.
Well, the flip side of that question is, I mean, just this is a digression, but...
It's all a digression.
I mean, if we could have the same wars without soldiers having PTSD, that would seem to be good. But I think the question that people raise is, if we can eliminate the risk of PTSD, will it make soldiers more likely to engage in the kinds of behavior or us to commit to adventures which are more likely to create horrors that they should have PTSD in reaction to?
Right. The best reason to get rid of war is PTSD, right? And not just in the soldiers, but in the civilians. Mm-hmm. And the model that Seligman has advanced with the Army, in the Army's view, is a model for civilians as well. I mean, Seligman's ambitions for this thing are huge. Mm-hmm. And his idea is that we should all learn to sort of be resilient to trauma, which, okay, if we're all going to face a certain amount of trauma, that's great. But he's not talking about the traumas that, at least I'm comfortable deciding, are inevitable. Mm-hmm. He's talking about war. Mm-hmm. So that's a good example of how, when you start to talk about this resiliency thing, you've really got to do some work figuring out what it is that we should be resilient to and what we might really should stay intolerant of.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be an undercurrent of, in relation to this, you ask the question in a number of different ways about the kinds of life events and experiences that shouldn't be subsumed into a diagnosis of depression, certain kinds of introspective or existential angst, which are the roots of a certain kind of spiritual or a philosophical self-understanding, or, for instance, lack of power in society. Shouldn't people have be unhappy in a society in which they have to fight this hard to get to be told that they have to buy private health insurance instead of have the same rights as every other industrialized nation? So I think that's the Brave New World question. It's, what if we come up with SOMA and people start taking it and they ignore all the bad things about their society?
And the interesting question there is, does SOMA, or Prozac for that matter, can it be understood simply as a molecule? Because, as I'm sure you know, there's all sorts of evidence that drugs have the effect that we expect them to have. And so the problem here isn't so much that people might be able to take drugs to feel better. The problem is the meaning that they make out of that feeling better. And what happens, it's not so much that I think people should, you know, suffer or have introspection or whatever. It's that the option is taken off the table intentionally by the diagnosis of depression as a biochemical illness. There's a very interesting and vexing discussion in Peter Kramer's book Against Depression, in which he says that it's the therapist, he's talking about himself as a therapist. He accuses himself of having gone on wild goose chases with his patients for trying to track down the meaning and the source and then the sort of the value of their depressions. He's talks about being scolded by a patient because really it was irrelevant. Mm-hmm. The only thing that was important was that there was something wrong with her brain. Now, Kramer is a really smart guy, and mm-hmm. he's a very humane guy, and he truly believes this, that the calling it an illness, the purpose of calling it an illness, or one of them, is to eliminate that preoccupation in favor of treating the disease understood as a brain problem.
Right.
So to me, when you take the option off the table, that's where you run into trouble. It right. isn't so much the drug itself. It's what you make. It's what you're told about it.
Well, this has been one of the really vexing questions in my investigation of this literature, and especially as a Buddhist. I've always had an anti-Freudian or anti-talk therapy attitude as a Buddhist, because the whole Buddhist approach to psychotherapeutic health is to let go of everything. Mm-hmm. Stop thinking about it, let go of it, be now here in the present. And so for a lot of Buddhists, the apparent efficacy of CBT fits in with that, which is just that, you know, notice what you're doing, name it, and move on. And on the other hand, there was a paper just published last week that looked at the depth of conversations that people typically had and their mood. And it turned out that people who don't like chit-chat and like to have profound, deep philosophical conversations are in general happier people. And so that's the other strain of the Aristotelian strain, that the examined life is what leads you to eudaimonic happiness. And I see evidence for both in the literature, the notion that self-understanding leads to happiness and the notion that self-understanding is just a trap and that you should live in the moment. So,
yeah, well, probably one of the things that's going on there anyway is that in therapy, what I think is going on, I think is happening is that we're telling stories. And I think we'd all be better off if psychotherapy was unnecessary. Not only because it might mean that we weren't as unhappy as we are, but because what we therapists are doing is we're filling a function that was taken care of differently in other societies, which is the function of sort of restorative storytelling. We're helping people fashion narratives of their lives. And to me, the problem with cognitive behavioral therapy is that it takes all the improvisation out of telling the story. It already knows where you're going to end up. Mm-hmm. I would say the parody of Freudian of psychoanalysis is the same thing. Of course, that's not true. It hasn't been true in many years, if it was ever true. But the idea that we can sit around and improvise on the themes of our lives with a person who's sympathetic and listening and, you know, carved out the time and pays attention and nothing else, no cell phones, no multitasking. You know, it's just you and me in a chair, and that we can just hang out and improvise on the themes of your life, people find that inherently valuable. Mm-hmm. Now, there should be other ways to do that, and it shouldn't cost as much money as it does. And I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me too hard, but, you know, that's true. But in the meantime, that's why I think it has value.
This has been the first half of an interview with Gary Greenberg about his book, The Manufacturing of Depression. For the second half of the interview, go to ieet.org.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org.
You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.